Welcome to the morning show on WRCO Radio. Today we have a real treat. Our friend Len Harris stops by to talk about his new book and join us here. He was here a year ago. And Len, good morning, by the way.
Good morning, Phil.
A year ago, I was encouraging us, hey, man, come back when you get that book done. And I guess it's the time now, huh?
It most definitely is.
Yeah. So is it a good fishing day today out there, is it?
Actually, when it's raining or overcast, it's the best time to chase trout because the rain knocks food into the water, and trout don't have eyelids, so they shun bright sunlight. So today would be the day. I went yesterday already, and I did pretty well.
Good.
I caught 20 in about an hour and a half, one 17, 18 inches.
Yeah, when I read the forecast just a moment ago, I thought, you know, I bet Len's saying this is a good day because you mentioned that in your book about you've been soaked a lot of times out there, but you're having fun doing it, right?
I always have fun fishing and talking about fishing and reading about fishing.
And you've written the book. This is your third. You said it was your final book?
I had this book sitting on the shelf for about 3 years, and I would say to my wife, is it time? She says, no, I don't think it's time. So I asked her enough times, she finally gave in and said, yep, it's time.
So it was sitting on the shelf for a little bit. When was your last book released?
My last book was released in 2015.
Okay. So you added a few stories. You know, these are all full of your stories, your fishing stories. How did you decide which ones would make it and which ones didn't?
Well, I had at least 40 to choose from, and the ones that tugged at my heart were the ones I decided to put in the book.
Okay. Yeah. Several of them do. Now, let's go back a little bit and how it all started. You lost your dad at a young age, didn't you?
I was 10, and he was deer hunting and overexerted dragging a deer out of the woods and died of a heart attack at age 40.
Wow. His impact on you, though, because he took you fishing, so you obviously, you took that the rest of your life, didn't you?
He would always have a lesson also when we'd go out. This time of the year is when all the wildflowers are coming out, and he would point them out. He would have oddball names for them that when I was older, I looked up because I thought a flower called a wart, that can't be correct. Well, it was all sorts of different kinds of warts, and they're coming out right now. When I went fishing yesterday, I was admiring them in between catching fish.
Yeah. Some of them, it's a little early, isn't it, for some of this stuff?
It's a little early. They're just barely poking their heads out of the brown grass, but the liver warts are out, the bloodroot are out. And that typically means, from a tale Dad told long ago, is the water is warm enough because the ground is warm enough. If the ground is frozen, the water is still really cold and the fish won't bite. But now the ground is thawed, the wildflowers are coming up, it's time to catch big trout.
One of my favorite chapters in your new book, Yesterday and Tomorrow, talks about your youth and your roots. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about collecting some pop bottles and how that had an impact on your future.
I had five sisters, and I was the only son, and I was right in the middle. And after my father passed, we were pretty poor. And my mom used to always tell me, you're lucky you have food and pants and shoes. And I was kind of a beggar, I'd say. The neighbor kids got a brand new bicycle or mini bike or some fancy this or that. And she'd say, he won't appreciate it as much as you do if you earn it. And I said, well, what do you mean? Well, there's all sorts of things you could do. My mom had a lot of friends from church, and she said, this young lady here, her husband died, and she's not that young anymore, and you can go get her groceries at the grocery store, and I guarantee you she'll tip you. And I did that quite often. I babysitted as a young kid. And my mom says, you know, there's pop bottles in the ditch in between the store and the high school. That's 3 cents a piece for redeeming the pop bottles. So every Saturday, I would go with a gunny sack, and I'd fill it full. And like today, when it's raining, that evening, I would go out with a flashlight, and I'd usually hold the flashlight in my mouth, crawl around on the football field in Gaze Mills and pick up night crawlers. And again, that was 3 cents a piece. And the local sporting goods store, it was Pettit's Tackle, would pay me for the night crawlers. And on a good night, I could get 1,000 easily. So near the end of the summer, I had enough money saved. My mom went to Boscobel and picked up the bike I wanted, and she had them put it together. And I took it and showed it to every single one of my friends on the block. And all of them were just blown away that I bought it with my own money, that my dad or mom didn't supply it to me. And there's a life lesson there. If you want something bad enough, you can figure out how to get it.
Do you remember how much the bike was?
Oh, my. I think, if I remember right, it was like $23. Well, that was in 1969, I believe, that I got the bicycle.
But still, at 3 cents a night crawler or 3 cents a pop bottle, you had to work to get that much, didn't you?
Well, the money was saved, but every once in a while, I'd have to go to the store to buy a fishing lure or a candy bar. So it took me a little longer than I wanted. It was a huffy, yellow, butterfly handlebar banana seat. I don't know if it had a specific name, but it seemed perfect for me, and it took me to all my streams. My mom was busy, so she would say, be home by dark. I don't want you riding your bike in the dark. And it was my vehicle to get out to the streams.
So that bike meant everything to you as far as getting out there and watching, you know, where you were going to go fishing and everything.
Exactly. It was part of my fishing gear.
How many times did you come home with fish on the handlebars there from your stringer?
I lost track of how many times. I recall one time that I caught a gigantic pike when I was trout fishing. And with my hand on the handlebars hanging on to the pike on the stringer, its tail drug on the ground. It was that big.
My goodness. Hard balancing your bike and hauling the fish home, I'm sure.
Well, then with the fishing pole over your shoulder also. I was so full of adrenaline then that it really was a quick trip back home. But I usually drove up and down Main Street a few times to show my people my catch.
Yeah.
And there, I didn't just eat them myself. My father had a list at the grocery store and the gas station of people that wanted fish. And I kept it going after he passed. I supplied pike and trout and walleye to probably 3/4 of Gaze Mills.
Yeah. And that's where you grew up.
That was my hometown. Correct. Mm-hmm. Gaze Mills.
And you fished pretty much your whole life. Where did you go then after high school?
I went to Tech College in La Crosse for a year. And then for 7 years, 1 month and 11 days, I was in the active army. And 6 of those years, I was in Germany.
And did you fish there?
I only fished there one time, but it was after I got out of the service. It's quite a hard process to get to be able to fish in Germany. You have to go to a school, and it's not cheap. You have to pass a test. And most streams over there are owned by fishing clubs, and you have to have permission to get on there. And if the landowners want the fish that you caught, you are by law have to give them the fish. So the one time I went there was probably, it was 2015, and I went to southern Germany to a alpine stream. And one of my friends that still lives over there, he took me there, and he was a member of the Munich Fishing Club. And he said, you probably aren't going to catch anything. So I planned this trip for 6 months. I sent extra gear over. I sent extra waders over. He showed up at my hotel room knocking on the door. He said, I want to go scouting. Well, scouting meant fishing, but I hadn't picked up any of my gear. So we went out to this small stream, and I wanted to catch a grayling because I'd never caught one of those before. It's an oddball looking thing with a real big dorsal fin. The limit there was between the two of us, we could catch no more than a meter of trout. And there was no catch and release there. If you caught a 2-inch one and then you caught a 20 and a 20, you were done. So it took me 15 minutes to catch 3 15-inchers, and I was done. With all that planning, I was done.
You never get to use your gear then.
I literally had to go into an alpine stream fed by glaciers in my blue jean up to my belly button to land one because I didn't have my net. My wife was there and my friend Jan were there, and they were laughing so hard at me, both of them almost fell on the ground.
So are those fish, are they good eating?
Oh, such cold water. Uh-huh. They were pristine. We went to his house and I cleaned them, and none of them had ever seen a trout be cleaned before. And I did it so quickly, I said, wow, didn't know it was so simple. And then we had it on their grill, and there were 5 or 6 people there. So we each got about a mouthful, but I'm pretty good at cooking. I learned how to cook while I was in the service.
I was wondering, you didn't put any recipes in your books, though, did you, Lynn?
Well, recipes, there's not enough room for all the fishing stories. I can't take up space with recipes.
Lots of good stories. And in your new book, you have pictures of some of the people that that you've guided before, and some famous people as well, right?
Well, I quit guiding in 2009. It was just so hard on me watching people fish. When you guide, you cannot fish. If you carry a rod and reel, it's a backup. I quit in 09 because fishing without a fishing pole was like going to a gold mine without a shovel. My most famous client was Coach Bobby Knight. And my second most famous client was Bob Skowronski, Green Bay Packer, retired Ice Bowl era, 2 Super Bowl rings.
Yeah. So I'm sure people probably commonly ask you, what were they like, or what was it like? Coach Knight, I think, was probably a different guy fishing than he was when he was on the basketball court, wasn't he?
He was still quite focused, and if I told him that I thought there was going to be a fish in a run, and there wasn't, I would get a dirty look. I would tell him it wasn't because there wasn't one in there. It's because you didn't hit it quite right. That didn't go over well.
He didn't throw his fishing chair or anything, did he?
No. In fact, I took him trout fishing, and then later in the afternoon, I took him turkey hunting over by Gase Mills. One of my friends called for him, and he got impatient. He didn't want to sit in the blind that we'd set up. He wanted to stalk them, which is kind of hard. A lot of people do, but it was about this time of year, maybe a little later. But he had a stool that I drug along with. I carried the chair, not him.
Okay. Well, there's a great picture of him in your book, Yesterday and Tomorrow. It looks like he caught one.
He caught a really nice rainbow. And if you see it's a rainbow, you know it's either from Richland County or southward, because most of the counties around here do not have rainbows in them. And I'd say 99% of the rainbows that you'll catch around here are from the hatchery. They're broodstock that have gotten so old that they release to the catch and release only water.
Do you have any stories about Bob Skowronski?
Bob Skowronski learned how to trout fish when he was a Packer. He didn't know how to do it prior. And he was an honorary member of, I'm not sure which nation, but north of Green Bay, he was made an honorary tribe member. And they taught him how to fish for brook trout with a half of worm on a small wire hook. And he liked catching, but he did not keep any ever. In the whole time I went out with him, I probably went out with him over 100 times. When I first started taking him out, I took him out just because I liked listening to his stories. And partway, I guided for 5 years, and partway through the guiding, he started giving me Packer tickets just out of the blue. He'd say, I've got 5 for this Viking game coming up. Do you want them? I said, sure. So 5 rows up behind the bench, I could even see Brett Favre scratching his ear. I was so close. Bob would tell stories about back in the day when he first started playing football. He wore leather helmets with no face guard. And if someone would do you wrong, like they would try to cut block you, or they would stick their fingers in your eyes, you did it right back. Because if you didn't do it, they would think you were not manly enough, and they would do it worse. He was quite a character.
How is he as a fisherman, though?
Brook trout are the easiest trout to catch. You could nearly catch a brook trout with a bare hook. I counted one morning. We were fishing over by Towerville, and he caught 183 brook trout in 2 hours.
Wow.
So he's obviously pretty good at it.
That, I mean, you think about that, that's almost, you don't even hardly have time to take it off the hook and keep going if you're going to catch that many in that short amount of time.
He would always make his hook barbless, so it would be so much easier to get them unhooked. Uh-huh. And usually when you find one brook trout, you found 100. They school up, and over there we were fishing on a big beaver dam. And it was just fish after fish after fish. Most of them were fairly little. Brook trout are not very smart. You can drag a fish right through the middle of them, and they'll bite on the next cast. They won't run away.
They don't remember then.
No, they're instinctual feeders.
Mm-hmm. So you have some stories in there about trout that are pretty smart, though, as well. There's one about the big trout that was kind of hiding under the brush, the underbrush.
Well, I don't know about smart, instinctual. So I remember the story well. It's my biggest male small stream brown trout. I like to kid that I'm put together with rubber bands and shoestrings. I have a artificial left knee. I've had my right knee scoped twice. I had a back fusion. I had a compression fracture in my neck. Lots of times when I'm fishing, I have to sit down and rest. I was near the end of my fishing outing this day, and sitting down near the stream gave me a different view of the hole that I'd fished 100 times. And I thought, I've never casted underneath that branch before. It was down low enough. I casted from the seated position and actually skipped it across under it. And before it could get down even 6 inches in the water, it got hammered by the biggest small stream male brown I've ever caught in my life. And again, that day I was fishing without waders, and it required a walk-in up to my belly button. And it fought, and it ran, and it fought. It was very memorable.
And you landed it, though.
Most definitely. Yeah. I got my giant net off my back, and I went out and netted it after quite a while. On two of the covers of my books, I have me with my giant net.
Mm-hmm.
I actually get ribbed a little bit about my net, telling me that I have delusions of grandeur. But you will never hear a trout hunter say, I wish I had a smaller net.
Yeah, it's huge. It looks like a big snowshoe or something.
Well, it's actually a steelhead net that I got from a guy that makes them for a living up in Superior. It's a LDH nets, and it's a walnut with a maple inlay. It's quite a beautiful net.
So tell us about the picture on the cover of your book. Who took that?
Well, about 3 years ago, I ran into an ex-state senator from Richland Center, Dale Schultz. And we hit it off right away, and he talked me into taking him fishing. And he's hooked now. He prefers hunting with dogs more than fishing, but he finds time to fish. So we were fishing on a Richland County stream here, and I did not know he was taking a picture. And he showed it to me, and it was just jaw-dropping. It was the essence of trout fishing for me.
It's a beautiful one, and the back cover as well is another photo. Another of your friends took that one too, didn't they?
My friend Jim Furley, he's got a kind of a vacation retreat around here. He was always talking to me about wanting to go fishing. He's a walleye and pike and ice fisherman, and I finally talked him into going too. And these days, he's just as good or better than I am. He really is good at casting and casting into very pinpoint locations.
I love the pictures, though. They're almost 3D. It almost looks like you could walk right into them.
Well, my stories, I try to make 3D. When I write, it's like I'm trying to place you right there with me on the stream. All of my fishing stories have life lessons and fishing tips interwoven throughout the stories.
Yeah, that's what makes them special, that's for sure. So as you were talking to me before we went on the air about your blog, you used to publish a lot of pictures like this. I never even thought about this. People were trying to figure out where you were fishing then as a result, weren't they?
Well, I would go to my blog and there would be statistics and what picture was clicked on and how many times. And through my statistics on my blog, the folks weren't looking at my big fish. They were looking at my stream pictures, trying to figure out where I was fishing.
You couldn't keep it a secret then. I would imagine they figured it out in some cases, didn't they?
Well, they figured it out. And then I was kind of vain for a while there. I had a license plate on my vehicle that said fishing on it. And I would find people parked in my tracks the next day. So I switched that out.
That's like when somebody's fishing and catching, and then they move, and then somebody moves right in that spot to try their hand there, isn't it?
I had that happen to me once when I was fishing the Milwaukee River, and they couldn't catch anything. They moved on, and I went right back in there and caught some right behind them before they could even leave.
So you probably get asked all the time, Len, but what's the secret? Because I could probably fish the same water and sit there all day with the same worm or lure.
The key is big trout, which I try to think I specialize in. They did not get big because they were super smart. It's because of their environment. The tree trunks, the tree roots, the down tree, they are in the biggest, tightest mess there is. If you want to catch a big trout, you don't need to cast 300 yards. You need to be able to flip a little short cast with a worm or a spinner right into the snaggiest mess. And also, you don't want a flimsy rod. You don't want a 0 or a 2.8 fly rod or an ultralight spinning rod. You want to be able to get their heads up immediately and get them out of that mess, or you're just going to be hooking them. And then they're going to roll around in there, and you're going to lose the lure, and the fish is probably going to die because it's going to be entangled.
How often do you lose your lure, though?
If you don't lose lures, you aren't fishing right. Lots of people use too light of line. They have read all of the things in the magazine, think they have to use 1, 2, 3, 4 pound test. I have 10-pound test on my spinning rod, and I also use a medium-heavy spinning rod. It helps with distance, and it definitely helps with precision of my casts. And if I get something on, I can get that fish's head up. I keep talking about head up. When you get their head up, that usually means they get kind of put on their side. And when they're on their side, their tail, which is what motates them here and there, is nullified because it's not able to work the usual way it does. So you get them on the top, don't let them get back down in the water, this is one of my dad's sayings, or you'll be left singing in the pig pen.
I love it. So you hear the flapping of the tail of the trout when you're trying to land them then, right?
Well, usually when you're trying to land a big trout, you have such tunnel vision, you don't hear anything. A lot of people make a mistake when they cast. They don't try to pre-plan where they're going to land it at. If you're in a snaggy mess and you haven't figured out where to land that fish, you are going to lose it. pre-planning. I watched a guy have on one of the biggest trout I've ever seen. He had it to shore, and then it made another run. Then he got it up on its surface. He turned to me and said, "Get down there with my net, with your net." And I said, "I'm already there." So while he was distracted talking to me and not seeing me get down there in the water, he let the trout back in down into the water. The tail got in its power position. Zoom, snap. It was gone.
Took it right then. Wow.
It was done.
Ah, interesting. So that was, again, where you didn't get to use your big net that day then.
A lot of people don't know how to use a net. They try to go tail first when they net it. Fish cannot go in reverse. If you're going to net a fish, you should always net it head first. Usually when it sees the net, it makes one last wild tail on fire. I'm trying to get away. So you put the net going head first and you tilt the net slightly up. So if it makes that run, it runs right into the side of your net and it's done. So my net serves more than just netting. When I'm by myself, it has a nice long handle. I keep the trout in the water after I've unhooked it. I stick the handle of the net into the mud bank. The fish is reviving itself while it's in the nice deep net. I get my camera out. I take a focus pre-picture to make sure I've got it. I lift it with my left hand out of the water. I snap a picture, and it's gone within 3 seconds. So I'm not stressing the fish by doing all these glory shots or laying them on the ground.
How often do you keep a fish, or how do you determine if you're going to keep it?
Well, currently in April, you cannot keep them. It's mandatory catch and release here. Lots of times when I go fishing, I stop at the landowners at the beginning of the year and make sure it hasn't changed hands. And I ask the landowners, "Do you want a fish or two?" And I used to have a friend that I would always stop at her house just to talk to her. Her name was Sue Taylor. She loved fish, but she didn't know how to clean them. And she'd say, "I want two, and you know what size." So I would get two, and I'd go to her house right away. She used to run a beauty shop here and out in the boonies. Mm-hmm. And I'd clean them in her spigot, and she'd have them for supper, and she'd always share them with her son, Tim.
Yeah, that's awesome that you did that. We had some fellows in last week talking about hunting and how it's getting harder and harder to find places to hunt. Is it kind of like that with fishing, you know, with landowners that you're not familiar with and things like that?
Always in the beginning of the year, I don't assume that I have permission from the year prior. I drive by where I plan on fishing, and if there's different cars, or if I saw a for sale sign during the off season, or I see tractors where there weren't tractors, I knock on doors. And the best way to lose a fishing permission is to assume you have permission from year to next. A fish or two to these landowners goes a long way to get permission on there forever.
Yeah, awesome. Len Harris, our guest on the morning show. We've got some more fish stories coming up here when we return with more. We are talking fishing today. Len Harris is in the studio with us talking about his new book, Yesterday and Tomorrow, and with some fishing stories. Beautiful pictures in there as well. Some people that you might even recognize in there. Maybe some fish you recognize. One that I don't, Len, is the tiger trout that's pictured in there. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the picture is of Gary Peters from rural Richland Center. And if that would have been caught during regular season, that was catch and release season, that tiger trout would have been pushing state record size. Most times, tiger trout are really colorful. They almost look like tropical fish. Most colorful trout are males, and usually the more subdued ones are the females. They need to be able to blend in more to stay away from predators. So Gary and I went out, and it was, I think it was late March, about 3 years ago, and Within the first 30 yards, Gary had on a real oddball colored fish, and it was pretty big, so I had nothing in my imagination. It was a tiger trout, but it was, and we looked at it, and he popped a picture. Gary is like me. He fishes for anything that has a tail and gills, and we didn't really realize it was so big, but it would have been a state record, I believe. It's a cross between a male brook trout and a female brown. It's when a male brook trout can't find female brook trout eggs and just does his business wherever. They're a sterile hybrid. They do not reproduce. They're about as unusual as finding a 5-pound gold nugget in a stream. That's how rare they are.
I was going to say, that has to be rare. I've not heard of that before. So, interesting. And that was right around here then.
Correct. This one in particular is stream born. A lot of out west, they stock them. They create them in the hatchery. But these are stream born. And now that our brook trout population is way down, if you catch a brook trout in this stream, you should continue to try, because there's a good possibility that you might find a tiger in there. And they're very rare.
Some other good stories that I really appreciate in your book, Yesterday and Tomorrow. Maybe you could kind of relay the one about the man that you took out fishing that left his heart apparatus back in the car.
So my friend Roger Abram, he's from Madison. I took him about 10 years ago, and I took him because he was 76 back then, and that was when I was having knee and back problem. And I took him just to see someone who I thought was older and less spry than me to kind of give me a motivation to go out. So we're fishing, and we're really fishing hard, and the weeds were fairly tall, and his nickname is Abe. Abe fell in the water a couple times and just kept on going. So we walked back to the car, and I said, "Are you up for another stretch?" He said, "Sure." He says, let me change my shirt." So we went to his vehicle, and he took his shirt off, and I was just flabbergasted. He had things stuck to his chest in 3 or 4 places, and I've had tests done at the doctor's before, so I knew what they were. I said, "What in the heck?" He says, "Oh, they're for my heart monitor. Doctor's got me doing a test to see how my heart's doing." I said, "Where is it?" So I didn't want to get it wet. I left it in the car. So the story's called One More Cast. So if a 76-year-old who's supposed to be wearing a heart monitor fishing can go and not act like he's lesser of an angler for it, then I should be quiet about my knees and my back, I thought. So we went to an easy spot, I thought to myself. I wouldn't be able to live with myself if he had a heart attack. So I took him to a real easy spot that had some goats on it that had it manicured. So I left him on a hole to cast, and I turned around, and there he is laying flat on the ground. And I thought the worst, and he could see it in my eyes. He says, "Calm down, Len. My back is hurting. I just lay on the ground like this to put it back in alignment." So that was 10 years ago. He's still around. He had never taken a picture with a digital camera before, and his picture of me fishing, he saw the picture before he took it. He says, "Show me how to use that dang digital thing." So I showed him, and I got down in there, and I promptly had a fish on, and he took the picture, and I showed it to him, and he says, "That picture is what epitomizes trout fishing in Wisconsin Driftless area."
Awesome.
Abe, if you're listening, thank you.
Yeah. Awesome. I like the story, too, about your big fight with a fish, thinking it was a trout the whole time and wound up to not be.
Well, I was fishing. I like chasing pike also. And I was at my second favorite perch over in Gaze Mills. And I hooked into something that was just gigantic. And it was doing head shakes. And usually head shakes mean either a trout or a pike. And I really had to battle this fish for a long time. It ran downstream two or three different times. And I finally got it under control. And it was still shaking its head like crazy. As I got it to shore, I saw it. It was a carp. I had snagged it by its tail. It was about a 20-pound carp. I had already thought to myself, am I letting this fish go? Where is the mount going to go on the wall? When will my wife, Barb, say that's okay? Barb, if you're listening, thank you also.
It's funny that you say that because I have limited fishing history, but I do remember fishing the Willow Creek many times and thinking that, oh, this is a trout is putting up such a fight, and then only to find out it's a lowly carp.
Oh, carp fight so hard. Recently, seeing I said my wife's name and she's listening right now, we've taken up a new hobby, the wife and I. My wife's an RN and she takes really good care of me. And I'm quite stubborn. And we started chasing waterfalls. We've been driving all over the place looking for waterfalls in Wisconsin, Minnesota, the UP, all the way down to Arkansas. That's my newest hobby that I've added. And it is just so invigorating. It's almost, Barb, almost as good as trout fishing.
That's awesome. And you have some waterfall pictures in the new book, too, don't you?
I have one waterfall picture in the new book, and it was the very first one I ever saw in my entire life. I was on vacation, and there was this tiny little sign on the side of the road that said waterfall, and Barb insisted we stop, and we walked, and we walked, and it was right after I had my left knee replacement. And I was getting kind of wimpy and whiny, just only a little bit further, only a little bit further. So we heard it long before we saw it. And it was just a gigantic 220-foot waterfall. And it was on when we went on vacation, when I went trout fishing in Germany. And after we were done, we went down towards Austria, and that's where we saw the sign in Göhling, Austria. It lit my waterfall love, and we've been to at least 100 since then. And we've already got a next one planned in Owatonna, and then we're going to go up to the UP. We have a couple up there we want to see in the near future.
Are there some in the state of Wisconsin, state parks that you've seen?
Oh, my goodness. There are scads of them in Marinette County. There's one close down by Dodgeville. It's called Stephan Falls. That's a state park there. Patterson State Park. And then Copper Falls State Park.
Yeah, I was just there last summer and saw those. Pretty spectacular.
My most favorite one, it's kind of small. It's not a big one. It's called Devil River Falls. It's near Mirabel, Wisconsin. And it's right off of a campground parking lot. You have to talk to the owners, and because it's not widely known, and he'll tell you right where to go. And it's just beautiful. My wife takes good care of me. Like I said, she's an RN. She doesn't have me overdue. She keeps an eye on how much I fish. And she preaches to take someone with me most times. So someone could carry me out if I blow out my knee or something. I'm very accident prone. There's a story in there called Adrift in my book. It talks about all the things that I've injured in my life and how trout fishing has always centered me afterwards, and how the drive is there. If I can fish, all is right with me.
Yeah, there was the one story where you were persevering because your back hurt so bad and your whatever. You had all kinds of aches and pains, but you kept soldiering on, didn't you?
Yeah, and then it started raining. It was in May of probably 5 years ago. And my back was hurting so bad that I casted from the seated position again. And I learned that trick from Abe about laying down on shore to straighten your back out. And I did that afterwards, and I went back to the car, and it was raining really hard, and it really felt good.
Did you catch anything?
I caught, I believe, about a dozen. It was a short stretch because my back was hurting, but I caught one really nice male.
There are a lot of stories, fishing stories, about the one that got away, or the granddaddy of them all. Is there a fish that you still have in your mind somewhere that you'd like to meet up with sometime?
Well, most trout anglers don't consider a trout big until it hits 20 inches.
Okay.
And that's a brown trout. I have lost two that were close to 30 inches.
Wow.
And I went back after both of those at least 100 times each. And I don't know if they died of old age or I just wasn't throwing what they wanted. But I've witnessed two nearly to my net for people that were fishing that were just like megalodons. Great, big, long, scary-looking males with big hook jaws that I would like to catch. But that's why it's called fishing, not catching.
Right. In those cases, you just tip your hat to the fish sometimes, right?
Well, some of the time, the fish win. In the beginning of the year, I always make sure my gear's all oiled and cleaned and new line, and I change my line quite often. I can accept the fish winning, but what really burns me is if it's a operation error, or I was too cheap to buy new line.
Yeah. Now, I had no idea. There are different schools of thought. You have an open reel or a spinner? Is that
a spin casting reel?
Spin casting reel. Yeah. And then other folks use like a closed in reel?
Yep. There's closed face, there's spinning, and there's fly reels, and there's also a center pin reel, which is kind of a hybrid between a spin and fly rod.
And people are pretty opinionated on what they like and what they should use, aren't they?
I think the trout fishermen of Wisconsin are the most opinionated, with musky anglers being a close second.
Okay. So everybody has their idea, but now like what you use, you're looking more at fish that you would maybe keep?
I target big trout.
Okay.
I use big lures, big spinners. My rationale is the bigger the lure, the less likely a little trout can get its mouth around it and injure itself. Some people are of the school smaller is better, but they engulf the lure and it gets down into their gills. And if they're bleeding badly, they are going to die.
I never caught much as a youngster. They always blamed it on my mouth because I couldn't stop talking. But that's an old wives' tale, right? The noise?
My father would always give lessons when we went out. He told me, you can yell at the top of your lungs. The trout can't hear you yelling. But if you step on a twig just before you're about to cast, it'll send sound waves through the bank and into the water. He said, you might as well throw a boulder into your hole. You're not going to catch anything.
So that makes sense, though, too, because I was usually dancing around and kicking stuff, so that was probably part of it.
I used to beat on trees with sticks until my dad enlightened me.
Oh, that's awesome. Where can people get a hold of your book, Len, if they are interested in it?
It's on Amazon, and all three of them are on Amazon. I have them for sale. I like talking about fishing, but I don't like selling books. I don't know why. It seems to cheapen it a little bit. Kind of, when I used to do presentations at schools, I liked that the most because the young kids, I felt like I was opening the door to the outdoors for them.
Right. In many cases, maybe opening the door for reading, though, too, because I've talked to a lot of teachers, too. You know, you got to find that thing that the student is most interested in. And if they're interested in the great outdoors and fishing, this is a great book for them, too.
I had a kid that helped me with a presentation once 11 years ago. And I ran into him in Madison when I was testing out a new German restaurant there. He tapped me on his shoulder and he says, you're Len, right? I said, yeah. He says, "I'm Kevin." And I looked at him, and I thought, I don't know who this is. It was the kid that helped me with my presentation, helped run the slideshow projector. I remember going into the gymnasium and the teacher kind of pulling him to the side and telling him to sit still and be quiet. And I thought, well, I'm going to give him a task. I'm going to have him run my projector. So it gave him a sense of worth. He got a lot of pride out of it, and he was so into the presentation. As we left, the teacher thanked me for giving him a task. So I ran into this kid 11 years later. He was 22 then. He told me he had just finished his final year of college. And I remember during that presentation telling all these kids that initially I wanted to be a school teacher. And then I wanted to be a game warden. And ways lead on to ways. And I ended up doing something else. So when I got done talking to Kevin, as we parted, he said, "Yeah, I got a degree, and I'm going to be a game warden."
That's interesting. Wow. That you made an impression to remember you after all those years.
Well, I did about 50 presentations at schools and nursing homes and at Trout Unlimited chapters and hunting clubs. And I encouraged the people to bring their children along. The outdoors can be such a teaching tool.
Most definitely. Are you going out fishing today, Lynn?
I went out yesterday. I caught about 20. And I tried my seated cast yesterday, and I caught one. Just because I could cast at a different angle and lower, I skipped it underneath a tree limb. I caught about an 18-incher.
Awesome. Good for you. We hope people will check your book out yesterday and tomorrow. Lynn Harris, always a pleasure. Come back and see us again.
Thank you. I will.
It's a lot of fun to talk fishing. That's Lynn Harris on our morning show today from WRCO.